Facebook is holding an open meeting with employees today to let them ask questions about what's being called the Cambridge Analytica scandal. There have been many reports now on how Cambridge Analytica, founded by Republican operatives Steve Bannon and Robert Mercer, was able to use the data of 50 million Facebook accounts, most of them unaware of the mining, to target voters in the 2016 U.S. presidential election while working for the Trump campaign. This week, Britain's Channel 4 TV is releasing its investigation, showing the company offering other countries prostitutes and bribes to affect other elections. Facebook's stock price is down, and a number of lawmakers are calling on CEO Mark Zuckerberg to testify before Congress. MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi is here. He's also co-host of Velshi and Rule. And Ali, we're also seeing reports that Facebook's head of information security, Alex Stamos, will be leaving. What is Facebook saying about this? Is this an admission of some guilt, or is he being made a scapegoat? What's going on?
Well, it's unclear because it's not 100% clear that this was an information security breach. Facebook willingly gave over this information to a researcher, and it was supposed to be not used for the purposes it was used for and then destroyed. So it's possible that's an information security breach. I think most people think this was Facebook being irresponsible with people's information, although in fairness, Cambridge Analytica and the groups it's worked with have been the one who have used this information irresponsibly, but it sort of piles on to the whole conversation about, is Facebook a good custodian of all the information that we users give Facebook in exchange for a free user experience?
Well, let's back up. I've got two questions here, and it goes to the heart of how Facebook works. As you mentioned, this was a researcher who first built an app that he put on Facebook and gave the data he found to Cambridge Analytica. Does that violate Facebook's terms that he did that? And then, hold on, is this a problem with how Facebook works? Because his app, the company Facebook built this platform that allows these third-party apps, the app invited some users to fill out information but then scooped up their friends and family. Are other apps also vulnerable to this sort of Trojan horse?
So let me go backwards on this one. Yes. In fact, there are a number of articles that have come out on the internet today about how to get into your settings on Facebook and determine who you have given permission to use your data. But in this particular case, this researcher, authorized by Facebook to do some research, put out a survey on Facebook. About 250,000 people took the survey. But in doing so, they gave the app permission to access their friends and all sorts of other information, which Cambridge Analytica used to develop election targeting methodology. Now, to your first question, is this allowed? Is it legal? Facebook says that it is not allowed under the terms of their agreements. That's not 100% clear yet, first of all, whether that's allowed. It's also not 100% clear whether Facebook has breached an agreement that it had with the government, something called a consent decree back in 2011. It's also not clear what responsibility Facebook has for having known about this information since 2015 and now just disclosing it and conducting an audit because there were newspaper and television reports about it. So it's a very murky and complicated situation, but it does bring to bear how serious this issue is of your information and what's done with it.
Well, I mean, it's one thing for a researcher to violate the terms of agreement, but I think users expect the company to make sure he can't do that in this way
correct.
And build a
That's
firewall.
That's what the question is, correct.
You know, the stocks are, had fell, but is there a sense that people are deactivating their accounts?
So I've only, I've been covering this for several days, and I've only heard from two people who have canceled their accounts, and there's certainly no trending movement to cancel your account. You know, there are two issues, your privacy and how to manage it on social media, and the other issue is that somehow Facebook has gotten itself involved now. We already know that they were involved in the inadvertent or advertent spreading of fake news, but now Cambridge Analytica may have had influence over the U.S. election. So this sort of takes it to a new level of seriousness. Fundamentally, does a user know how to manage their private information on Facebook? And more importantly, are you susceptible to this targeted fake news or influence peddling that is going on? The stock has been down now for 2 days in a row, and I think part of that is fears that, A, they will be regulated as much as they have refused to have that happen to them, and, B, I think a lot of people are beginning to realize Facebook may be a dangerous place to be for them.
Exactly. Ali Velshi, MSNBC, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Well, Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the heir apparent to the Saudi throne, is meeting with President Trump at the White House today. It's the first stop in a 3-week U.S. visit, which also includes visits to New York, Boston, Los Angeles, and Silicon Valley. Joining us now is Ali Al-Ahmed, who is the director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
And what do you think Mohammed is looking for in this visit to the U.S.?
Most importantly, Mohammed bin Salman is trying to pave the way of the final phase of him becoming king. So he needs the support and approval even of the White House and other major political entities in the United States. And then using this opportunity as well to reward that support with the massive contracts in terms of arms and other deals, and also to give himself the title of a reformer. And that is something that the Saudi leaders have been doing since the 50s when they came to the United States. That's why you see a lot of money being spent in the United States now promoting Mohammed bin Salman as a reformer, and that has been done before.
Are there any U.S. businesses, though, that are wary about investing in Saudi Arabia right now?
I believe so. I think the retraction on the crackdown in the Ritz-Carlton really showed that he was told, Mohammed bin Salman was told, that no foreign person will come now because they do not trust they will be safe. And that has been the case, really, in most of the Gulf countries.
And by the way, you're talking about when Mohammed bin Salman rounded up many members of the royal family and basically jailed them in the Ritz-Carlton in Riyadh.
Yes, and not only members of the royal family, but a lot of businessmen as well, billionaires who, yes, they were corrupt, absolutely. Most of them were, at least. But the way this basically was done in a very, it was a shakedown, I think it scared off many, many international investors. The political system, which is in the hand of few, does not make it a very safe place for investment, especially when the king or the man in charge can change the laws and can tell the courts what to do. And this is, I think, the major problem for Saudi Arabia and its neighbors.
Do you think Mohammed views the Trump administration as a reliable friend to Saudi Arabia?
The Saudi monarchy has really seen every administration in a very opportune way, meaning that if they deliver what we want, we praise them no matter their domestic policy. And I think they see in a Trump a person who likes to make money. He has a big ego, and they have figured him out. And I think that's why now Mohammed bin Salman's inviting Trump to Riyadh and that big or massive reception. And now Mohammed bin Salman is bringing an excess of 1,000 people to Washington. That's part of the charm to win the Trump support and his administration.
What about what's going on in Yemen? Saudi Arabia is waging a war against the Iran-backed Houthi rebels there. There's an effort in Congress to cut U.S. military support for the Saudi campaign in Yemen, which has already killed 10,000 civilians and wounded 40,000 since it began in 2015. Is it an important priority for Mohammed to convince the U.S. to keep supplying arms to the Saudis? And how do you think the U.S. will react?
The United States, I think, in the words of Secretary of Defense Mattis, will continue to support the Saudi war in Yemen. And the using of the Iranian excuse, I think it's overblown, because in Yemen, if you count the Iranian weapons versus the American and British weapons, they don't compare. I think that's much more of an excuse. Saudi Arabia has been involved in Yemen for more than three decades. It's the big brother in Yemen, basically. So I think he will continue to want to wage this war because it gives him stability at home. When there is war on the border and abroad, people inside tend to remain silent, and it really defers any calls for reforms, real reforms, and participation of the people in power in that country. I think that has been always the Saudi monarchy tactic, creating external crisis so they can have a free hand domestically.
Does this visit by a Saudi crown prince feel different to you than previous ones?
Yes, I think this is for the history books. This is the largest foreign delegation that arrived to Washington or to the United States ever. So this is one. Secondly is you can see the consensus, especially from the Republican side and from those countries, their allies in Washington, be the UAE, Israel, and others. I have not seen so much support for Mohammed bin Salman in Washington, and I think that's due because he is agreeing with them, especially in terms of the peace process in the Middle East, where there will be some kind of a deal where the Gulf countries will have an open relationship with Israel and will defer the resolution of the Palestinian issues until that's done. And I think that's very clear to me that there is a great support for him within the Washington cabal, if you want, if I may say.
That's Ali Al-Ahmed, who is the director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Today, First Lady Melania Trump is meeting with tech industry leaders at the White House to talk about cyberbullying. And as we continue our series on bullying, we're going to hear in a moment from someone who says he regrets bullying someone online when they were younger. But first, Francie Deep. When she was 13, she became the victim of cyberbullying. And years later, for an article in The Atlantic, she confronted the woman she suspected of being her bully. Francie, start by telling us what happened.
Well, I'd had a friend. She was probably my best friend in school at the time. And we had a sort of a falling out. I don't really know or remember why, and I think she doesn't either. But after we had this falling out, I noticed some things happening in my email. So I would log into my Yahoo account, and all my emails would have disappeared. And sometimes there would be one email left in there with a nasty note to me. And, yeah, the worst thing that happened was that whoever was doing this would leave reminders in my calendar for me to kill myself.
Really? Just you would get a calendar reminder saying you should kill yourself?
Yes, I don't remember exactly how it worked, but I do remember, you know, I would just be browsing on my computer, and then I would get this sort of pop-up reminder, often for late at night.
And this went on for how long?
For a surprisingly long time, 3 years, I think.
3 years. And this person had your password, right?
Yes, that's right. So I never fully confirmed who it was that did this, but the girl I'd been friends with when I was 13, I knew she had my password. It was actually because at some point we were playing on the computer together, and I typed up my password in to log into my email account, and I'd accidentally had my cursor in the username box, so she saw it. And it was an inside joke that was actually between the two of us, so, you know, it was, she knew what it meant. And at the time, again, the late 90s, there was no way to change your security questions. Mm-hmm. So I would change my password. And then because the security question was also an inside joke between us, this girl was able to just change the password to whatever she wanted, whenever she wanted to get in. Just because no one else would have known the answers to these questions, she must have been at least involved in one of the break-ins. But it's possible that she shared the... It's possible it wasn't all her, but it had to have started with her.
What did this do to you?
You know, I was very unhappy. I think kids are always unhappy in junior high anyway, but this didn't help. And I, as I talked about in my story, I did at some point want to die, which sounds very funny for, you know, I was a little girl from a loving family. Living in a beautiful town in Washington State, it seems strange to say that I would want to do that. But, you know, you don't have a lot of great emotional regulation at 13 and 14, so things seem really serious when things go bad. I would say I had trouble making friends and, like, trusting friends afterward. But I made it through. I got into a college out of state, which is something I really wanted, and went away to college and lived the rest of my life.
And did you tell your parents or friends while this was going on at all?
I did tell my friends. I did not tell my parents, which is horrifying when I think about now as an adult. That is the scariest thing to imagine, being a parent and having a little girl 13, 14, 15 not tell you when something like this happens? That said, when I did confront my bully later, she also said she would have never told her parents. It's hard to get back into that mindset because it's just a strange one, you know, being a 14-year-old girl. Mm. But at the time, it seemed inconceivable. I thought that adults would make it worse somehow.
Now, you did end up contacting and confronting this person years later. What happened?
She was on Facebook. So the wonderful thing about social media is that you can never get away from these old people. She was on Facebook. We had a lot of mutual friends. You know, we'd gone to junior high and high school together. I can't remember exactly now how I convinced her, but it took a long time. I remember that sort of messaging her on Facebook back and forth. Before she would talk to me. I tried to get her on the phone, but she never did want to talk on the phone.
So what did she say when you confronted her?
She said at first she didn't remember anything, and then when I sort of told her more details, she sort of admitted to remembering more. She did admit to breaking into my email. She said she didn't remember setting the calendar reminders. Sometimes people ask me if I believe her. It's hard to know. It seems incredible that she would not remember, but it's also possible, I think, that those calendar reminders were very scary for me and stuck in my mind for a really long time, but it may not have been that big of a deal to her.
Or she just might not be telling you the truth now.
Yes. I mean, that's also possible. So it's either that or she honestly doesn't remember because it wasn't important to her. I think that's also very possible.
Do you feel better having confronted her?
I do feel a lot better. That's actually not an effect I expected. I was like, okay, I got to do this for the story. So I did. But in the end, it was amazing. One totally unexpected effect of this bullying was that it stuck around with me for a long time. You know, I felt so good about myself. I was like, okay, I'm going to college. I'm going to live my adult life. I'm going to be a writer, which I always wanted to be. But I would still check her social media accounts. Social media makes it so easy to do things like I looked up like her wedding pictures, and it made me feel bad. It made me feel bad that I had the urge to do that, and it made me feel bad doing it. Like, it didn't feel good, like, looking her wedding pictures. Like, that's weird and gross. So after I confronted her, the urge to check up on her really went away. Writing about this, talking with her did make me feel a lot better, and I'm so happy it did because it was not something I expected to happen.
That's Francie Deep, who is a writer with Pacific Standard Magazine. We'll link you to more about her story at hereandnow.org. Francie, thank you.
Thank you.
And now we turn to Tyler Gregory, a former cyber bully, now a project consultant for National Organizations for Youth Safety. Tyler, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And when we say that you're a former cyber bully, tell us what that means. What did you do?
Sure. So it was my junior year of high school, so it was about 7 years ago. I grew up in a very small town, very rural community, graduating class of 63 students. And I had my core group of friends. There's about five of us. And one of the other friends in this group, his name was Scott, he started hanging out with another girl from a different school, and that didn't really sit well with the rest of the group of friends. We're like, you know, why isn't he wanting to hang out with us? Why would he rather hang out with her? And so, you know, the four of us, we kind of went on social media and took out our frustration towards this girl whom we had never met. And looking back, I'm like, how in the world would I have been able to have said some of the things, you know, talked about her weight, we talked about her appearance, and really just to make her feel bad. I think it really stems from, you know, doing cyberbullying. You don't have to, you know, you're not face to face with the person you're bullying. It makes it a lot easier. You're not seeing the reaction. If there is a reaction, you're not, you know, giving them an opportunity to necessarily retaliate unless they message you back or comment on something like that. And it all came to an end once we were at a fundraising event, and one of the other friends in the group got on the phone and told this girl that, you know, the world would be a better place without you. Why don't you just kill yourself? And that really, you know, struck a chord with me because I was like, I never really thought about that. You know, I never thought that the things that we were saying could actually lead to her harming herself. And, you know, that's really when the bullying stopped after that point. And, you know, Scott, the friend who was hanging out with her, got involved and was like, you know, you guys stop just everybody stopped, basically. And that's kind of when things stopped.
And as you look back on it now, do you understand why you were involved in that in the first place?
To an extent, you know, like I said, it was a small school. So it really was about fitting in, and it was about, you know, just getting some laughs out of my friends. And as messed up as that sounds, it's very common among schools all over the country now.
And have you ever apologized to the girl?
Yeah. So a year later, it was Labor Day weekend. Scott and I had actually started an anti-bullying campaign, and we were at this fair of sorts, and she happened to be at the festival, and we saw her, and we, you know, took the opportunity to apologize. And I'm really glad that we did, because, you know, at that time we were getting a little bit of local media attention for the anti-bullying efforts that we were doing. She was seeing this on social media and on the news and stuff, and was like, that this is not the person I know. And so it was nice to have the opportunity to apologize. And she said, you know, she was glad that we were doing good work.
What would your advice be to a bully?
My advice for a bully would be to really just take a step back and think about what you're doing. We don't know what everybody's going through, whether it's our coworkers, our neighbors, you know, and the students who we sit next to in class every day. We don't know what happens at home. Even maybe some of your close friends, you might not even realize some of the things that they're going through. And so we basically have the power to control how people think about us. You know, when I look back on high school, I remember the people who weren't necessarily so nice, and I remember the people who were, you know, extremely nice. You know, if you have that option to control how people view you, why not, you know, choose the positive way?
That's Tyler Gregory, who is a project consultant for National Organizations for Youth Safety. He's been talking to us about his former life as a cyberbully. Thankfully, that is over now. Tyler, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Jeremy.
Six months ago today, Hurricane Maria made landfall on Puerto Rico, knocking out power to the entire island. Today, blackouts are common, and there are more than 100,000 homes and businesses still without electricity. Here's FEMA's Mike Byrne speaking to ABC's Eva Pilgrim.
The bad news is it was tragic. Okay, the good news is we had a chance to build it back the right way.
How long will you guys be here?
As long as it takes, but, you know, 5 to 10 years is not outside the realm of the possible.
5 to 10 years. Let's get an update now from David Ferris, a reporter for Energy and Environment News. He's just back from Puerto Rico. David, how are people there coping?
There are lots of people in the mountains still without power. You can drive for miles through there and be in the dark at night, where people have been living without power for 6 months, which is amazing.
Yeah.
In the cities, the power has returned. And so, you know, like you said, there are still intermittent blackouts that remind people that things are not back to normal. But people are back to work and trying to recover from the huge hit that the hurricane made to electricity and to their lives in many ways.
Well, so people using generators and fuel it where they don't have the electricity. The Puerto Rican Senate passed two bills last week that would privatize the island's power company. PREPA, Puerto Rico's public power utility, was deep in debt before this storm. It came under fire after the hurricane for hiring that expensive contractor with political ties, Whitefish Energy Holdings. This is a tiny company
yes.
in Montana. $300 million contract to rebuild the grid. A contract later canceled because of the public backlash. So what's the sense of what's going to happen with PREPA?
The power company has shown that it really can't do its job anymore. It was in bad shape before the storm hit, and it was kind of polished off by the hurricane. So is the writing's on the wall that privatization is going to happen. The question is how it's going to happen and how it's going to be assured that what replaces the current power company creates power at affordable rates and possibly also creates a new kind of grid.
Well, and the talk of, you know, taking years to do this to get it right, there was talk of renewable energy, microgrids, you know, something more resilient to disasters. Is that on the table?
It is on the table. It's unclear to me how it's going to be paid for, because presumably whoever is building those microgrids and building all that solar wants to be paid for it. But you're talking about the company that owns those assets is $9 billion in debt. And the people that it serves are also economically not doing well. The GDP in Puerto Rico is lower than any U.S. state. And so it's a little unclear to me how you go about going from that beleaguered situation into building a new grid. But there are a lot of people on the mainland who want to figure out how to do it.
And just briefly, David, there was this huge diaspora right after the storm, Puerto Ricans coming to the mainland, moving into towns all across America, staying with relatives. Has that stemmed?
Well, one thing that I saw that really struck me on the way back from Puerto Rico just yesterday was the line of wheelchairs with people in them, of course, waiting to get on the plane. So people, like the elderly and infirm, are still being sent away. Everyone knows someone who's left, or many people who have left. Some know some who have returned. But if you ask them, you know, are your friends planning to return? Often the answer is no, or not until the situation improves. And it's not clear the situation is going to improve markedly anytime soon.
David Ferris, reporter for Energy and Environment News, thank you.
Sure, absolutely. Take care.
And it's hard to imagine what it's like in Austin, Texas today. This morning, police sent a hazardous materials team to a FedEx facility in Austin after a report of a suspicious package there. They're still investigating that. And overnight, another package at a FedEx facility miles south near San Antonio on its way to Austin exploded on a conveyor belt. And now police say they found a second unexploded bomb in a package at that facility. And, of course, four bombs now have gone off in different residential neighborhoods in Austin. The first were left on doorsteps. They exploded when someone picked them up and, in one case, brought one inside. Two people have been killed, four injured. And two more were injured on Sunday when that bomb was set off by a tripwire near the entrance to a hiking trail. Bomb experts are reportedly flooding into the region, flying in from across the country. What are they thinking? Well, let's bring in former FBI profiler Clint Van Zandt. Now, his job is speculation. We want to stipulate that. But his guesses are educated. When he first retired, he helped expose Ted Kaczynski as the Unabomber in the 80s and 90s. So he knows from where he speaks. Clint, welcome back. And what are you thinking, hearing all these reports?
Well, it's really a challenge right now. I heard an FBI agent suggest this is the Bureau's most important case in the country right now. And I think that's probably true because it is so deadly and the potential for it to grow more deadly. As you suggest, there was an initial explosion, a packet explosion. Then we went 10 days. Then we had two more. Then we went 6 days and we had an explosion. And now we've gone 2 days. So the individual or individuals that are building and using these devices, they've shown a very interesting ability to change the triggering of the devices themselves, to change the target. They're staying one step ahead of law enforcement. We assume, like in the case of most bombers, they have a message. They have something they want to say. Law enforcement's indicated we're here to listen. But so far, that message has not been conveyed.
Well, we're reminded, though, that you were able to track down or expose Ted Kaczynski because it was his brother, David, who came to you, who had suspicions. So maybe a family member might come forward. I mean, why? That was pretty, seemed remarkable to us, the police reaching out to the bomber or bombers and saying, what do you want? What are you trying to say? Was that unusual?
Well, I think it's based upon our experience with the Unabomber. Now, Ted Kaczynski's brother, David, as far as I'm concerned, he was a national hero.
Right.
He had his suspicions. He came to me just after I'd left the Bureau. We did an analysis that suggested the Unabomber's manifesto and letters from Ted were the same. He went to the FBI, and of course, that solved the Unabomber case. But we look back through history, we have like George Metesky, the so-called mad bomber in New York in the 40s and 50s. He was angry because he had been fired by Con Ed. You've got Eric Rudolph, the Olympic Park bomber, 96, 98, who, for amongst other things, didn't like abortion clinics Of course, we talked about Kaczynski. And then there was Luke Heldler, the so-called Midwest pipe bomber. He was the young man who traveled 3,200 miles putting pipe bombs in mailboxes all across the country because he was trying to paint a giant smiley face with explosives on a map of the United States. So the motivation that we see in serial bombers, which these individuals are, has been, it's across the board. And there's nothing to suggest international terrorism. Of course, ATF and FBI are looking for any similarities between any international group that might use something like this. But right now, it appears this is someone local. And of course, this person didn't just fall off of a turnip truck last week. There's some motivation, some reason.
Right. Well, you say serial bomber. I don't think officials have declared that yet, but it would seem that way. But if it were copycat bombers as well, I mean, how long does it take to build these bombs? Do these appear sophisticated to you, in which case it might take a while?
Well, what's going to take a while, too, is the triggering devices. The first devices, it appears, when they were picked up or, as you suggested, brought into the house, there perhaps was some type of pressure switch or mercury switch when tilted.
Could it be a remote, somebody watching someone pick it up on a porch?
I think law enforcement would be wise not to take anything off the table right now, which, of course, means you're looking in a 360-degree circle to try to figure out who the bomber is and where he, she, or they are at.
Obviously, people in Austin are on edge and on alert.
Very sure.
What can you look for? I mean, what might somebody be buying more of? We don't want people to become vigilante, but what can you be looking for?
Well, one of the things that, of course, authorities will be looking at is the components of the bomb. And we're told, at least in the last two devices, the shrapnel inside the bombs included nails. So if you or I were FBI agents, we would say, okay, we've got 5-penny nails or 10-penny nails. Let's go to every hardware store in Austin and eventually Texas, if we have to, and see who's bought up a large amount of these nails within the last month, 6 months, something like that. So, you know, that's why they have at least 500 federal agents. I assume they've got 1,000, 1,500 law enforcement officers on this. This is the time any theory, any tip, you still run down because you've got the manpower to do it at this moment. And shame on them if they don't.
Well, and what else are you thinking as you look at all of these? You know, might somebody have made these bombs in advance since the pace is quickening?
I think they could have made the bombs in advance. And, you know, we continue to look at the analogy with the Unabomber. We also have to consider the D.C. snipers back in 2002, where one of the two, Mohammed, the belief was that he was doing this because his ultimate target was going to be his wife, so he could get custody of his children. Mm-hmm. And therefore, he perhaps committed all of these other crimes so that when he ultimately did something to his wife, that it would look like she was just a random victim of opportunity. That's something law enforcement has to consider. There are a lot of options, a lot of choices on the table, and it's being driven by the forensic, the behavioral investigations, and then just the men and women of law enforcement that are burning up shoe leather on the street, trying to find out if there's any connection between the victims, or are they all just random victims in a crazy man's mind.
Or woman. Clint Van Zandt.
Yes.
Former FBI profiler. Thank you so much, Clint. We might be touching base with you again.
Okay, thank you.
Well, he mentioned the Maryland sniper, so staying with gun violence. Last week, the National Rifle Association made its clearest public statement to date on red flag laws. These are the laws that give courts the power to temporarily remove guns from people thought to be dangerous or unhinged. Gun control groups believe such a law could have prevented the mass shooting in Parkland, Florida last month. And as NPR's Martin Casti reports, the gun rights group now seems to be open to such laws, at least on the surface.
Take a listen to this video from an activist group. It's a major player in the debate over gun violence.
We need to stop dangerous people before they act. So Congress should provide funding for states to adopt risk protection orders.
Any guesses yet which group this is?
These laws allow a court to intervene and temporarily remove firearms when a person threatens violence to themselves or others.
That was a video produced by the NRA, posted on YouTube last week. It's basically advocating for what gun control groups call red flag laws, which many think could have been used to disarm the school shooter in Florida. Groups such as Every Town for Gun Safety have been campaigning for years for red flag laws, and they've always assumed that the NRA opposed them. So now, they're not sure what to think. Shannon Watts is the founder of Moms Demand Action, which is affiliated with Everytown.
You know, we just never know with the NRA.
Watts says if the NRA is serious about supporting red flag laws, that would be a big departure from its previous position.
Well, I mean, the NRA has put out press releases about red flag laws, calling them, you know, firearm surrender bills, which is completely inaccurate and incendiary rhetoric.
The NRA is now getting flack from the other side, from supporters who see this as too much of a concession on gun rights. The video attracted angry comments on YouTube, and a day later, the NRA posted a clarification saying that it supports temporary gun removals only when people meet the legal standard for involuntary commitment. That's a higher bar than the red flag laws that have passed recently in places such as Washington State and California, and that higher bar adds to Shannon Watts' skepticism.
Some of this with the NRA is often an effort by the lobbyists to look moderate, but it's really just a head fake. That said, their desire to look moderate in the wake of the shooting in Parkland speaks really to the power of this moment, and maybe even the gun lobby realizes that their positions are not popular.
Watts says 22 states are now considering some form of red flag law, and she'll be watching the NRA's response to those in the state legislatures. NPR asked the NRA for an interview on this, but it didn't hear back. Martin Costi, NPR News.
And here and now, resident chef Kathy Gunst is here to talk about lamb. It is a meat that's going to be appearing on tables a lot in the next few weeks. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Jeremy.
Now, I love lamb, although I didn't always. When I was younger, I didn't love it. But for some reason, my taste buds changed a little bit at some point, and now I think it's great. But not everybody loves lamb.
No, they don't. A lot of older people who grew up eating mutton, which are very old sheep, really dislike it. They smell it, and they have bad childhood memories. I was recently on a farm in Windham, Maine, the North Star Sheep Farm, and I talked to Lisa Webster, who runs the farm with her husband, and she jokingly said, oh, those people that don't like lamb are all mostly gone. But it is an older generation because you don't see that anymore. Lamb is an incredibly juicy, delicious meat, way easier to cook than most people think. And I don't know, somehow a lot of cooks and eaters have this idea in their head that cooking lamb is really difficult. It couldn't be further from the truth.
Well, and it smells incredible, what you've got in front of us that our listeners can see at hereandnow.org. But tell us what you've brought here when we're talking lamb.
Let's start with those meatballs, because for people who maybe just want to start out trying something very simple, these are lamb meatballs. It is literally just ground lamb, garlic, thyme, fresh mint, feta cheese, you brown it, and then I serve it on top of a yogurt dill sauce.
Basically a tzatziki sauce.
But it has no cucumber at all. It's just a little bit of lemon and yogurt and herbs. And yogurt and garlic and thyme and rosemary really go very nicely with lamb. These are flavors that you'll see repeated over and over. But these meatballs take 5 minutes to put together, 5 minutes to cook, and the yogurt sauce is just a few ingredients. So a really good kind of lamb 101 dish if you're just getting started cooking lamb.
And an appetizer, kind of?
Could be.
Not a main course.
Well, given that you're about to have lamb three ways, it is your appetizer.
Well, and let's talk about that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, let's talk about this chop you've got right here.
This is from a rack of lamb. Yes, and this is very interesting. The crust is pistachio, panko breadcrumbs, garlic, and fresh herbs. A rack of lamb is probably the most elegant presentation, other than a leg of lamb is pretty spectacular also. But the rack looks so special. It's perfect for a holiday. And again, so easy. People are like, oh, whoa, a rack of lamb. Like they think it's got...
It's not as hard as you would think.
It's a bunch of lamb chops.
Well, and you just have to basically cook it for the exact amount of time that you
Correct.
Need to, right?
When you're cooking lamb, the best thing to do is to have a meat thermometer. And you always need to remember when you're roasting lamb that it will continue to cook when it comes out of the oven. The other thing that's worth mentioning is that lamb is an incredibly rich and flavorful piece of meat. Generally, when you are served it in a restaurant, you get far less ounce-wise than you would with beef. Because it's so fully flavored, you don't need to eat as much, so it tends to be better for you. It's got omega-3s, it's got fatty acids. It's actually quite good for you. And the majority of lamb in the United States is grown on small sheep farms. There are more than 80,000 family farmers and ranchers in the U.S. that care for over 6 million sheep. And this meat that you're eating is from Maine. It's from my butcher at Maine Meat. But the big five sheep-producing states in the U.S. are Texas, California, Colorado, Wyoming, and South Dakota.
And this is a shoulder cut, see that often.
No, you don't. And this is the secret of all secrets. If you get anything out of this segment, I urge you to try a shoulder of lamb. It is a less expensive cut, and it is the most forgiving cut maybe of meat that I've ever cooked with, meaning I braised it very slowly with some wine, fresh rosemary, lemon zest, garlic, of course, and olive oil for about 3 hours.
Wow.
And Jeremy, try it. You don't need a knife. You literally could eat it with a spoon. It's that tender, right?
Mm. It's like a coq au vin of lamb.
But for me, it's like the brisket of lamb. It's like fork tender, falls off the bone.
That's delicious.
You can buy it boneless or with a bone. And honestly, I'm going to tell you this. You cannot screw that one up.
How often do you have lamb?
Once a month.
Once a month.
Yeah. In the summer, I love to get a leg of lamb and have it butterflied, which is when they take the bone out and the two flaps open and it looks like a butterfly. And I marinate it in fresh mint and red wine and throw it on the grill.
I'm just thinking of the scene from My Big Fat Greek Wedding when they find out that the boyfriend doesn't eat meat.
Right.
And the aunt says, "What do you mean he doesn't eat meat? Okay, fine, we'll have lamb."
Exactly.
There we are.
The alternative meat. I'm a huge fan of it. I think these three recipes really show off how really versatile it is, and none of them are complex.
Kathy Gunst, Here and Now's resident chef, and we will link you to these recipes from Kathy. And you can see this delicious lamb at hereandnow.org. Kathy, thanks so much.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.